And welcome to the December edition of the JS Unplugged podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Pierce, pediatric sports surgeon at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, Virginia. This month, we take a look at surgical site infections and how to prevent them with a research article titled "The Effect of Operating Room Size on Orthopedic Surgical Site Infection Rates." Finally, we dive deep with Dr. Guillaume Gonzalez-Lomez as we explore deep gluteal pain in orthopedics, a challenging diagnosis from our December 15th edition. Let's jump right in. This podcast is brought to you by Modernizing Medicine, helping orthopedic practices fight burnout and connect with patients. Modernizing Medicine offers an orthopedic-specific suite of healthcare IT solutions, including the number one ortho-specific EHR system, EMA, practice management, billing services, analytics, patient engagement tools like telehealth, and more. To see a two-minute demo, visit modmed.com/orthopod. The article we cover this month is a research article titled "The Effect of Operating Room Size on Orthopedic Surgical Site Infection Rates" out of our December 1st issue. This is by Dr. Tyler Tantillo and colleagues. Operating room size has not been investigated as a risk factor for surgical site infection for orthopedic procedures. This study was a retrospective study looking at 11,163 patients undergoing one of four orthopedic procedures, which were total knee arthroplasty, total hip arthroplasty, laminectomy, or spinal fusions, and comparing the overall surgical site infection rate to the total net square footage of operating room space. Operating room size was broken down into three categories, with small being 250 to 399 square feet, medium being 400 to 549 square feet, and large operating rooms considered to be 550 to 699 square feet. This excludes storage space. These numbers were based on the hospital engineer measurements. Overall, the group found a 1.2% or 137 patients out of the over 11,000 were seen to get a surgical site infection, which was defined as a patient meeting any of the National Healthcare Safety Network criteria, including erythema and pain around the incision, purulent wound drainage, and associated fever. All surgeries were performed in a total of 78 operating rooms across 8 hospitals, all within the same health system. 5 of these hospitals were community hospitals and 3 were tertiary care centers. All operating rooms had similar air handling standards. Additionally, the patient's demographics, including diabetes mellitus and age, as well as surgical factors such as OR time and duration, urgency of the case, meaning emergent or non-emergent surgical procedure, complexity of the case, and closure type, meaning primary or secondary, were all taken into consideration as distracting variables to decide on operating room size impact for surgical site infection. Using a 2-step cluster analysis and chi-squared test, surgical site infection rate and rate per operating room size was determined. Overall, a 1.2% or 137 patients had the surgical site infection as discussed. 16 cases or 11.7% of the infections occurred in a small operating room. 83 infections, or 61% of overall infections, occurred in a medium-sized operating room. And 38 infections, or approximately 28% of infections, occurred in large operating rooms. Independent risk factors for surgical site infection were found to include the following: fusion procedures, younger age, longer procedure duration, higher ASA scores, emergency or trauma procedures, and medium-sized ORs. Overall, the group recommends that minimizing operating room traffic and improper space allocations are very important factors to improve the surgical site infection numbers. We will need more studies in the future to delineate more carefully what size operating room affects surgical site infection and other outcomes. But overall, I think we can all agree that minimizing the number of throughput traffic through an operating room during an operative procedure should help decrease the amount of bacteria in the air and microbials in the air to help minimize surgical site infection. Welcome to the interview portion of the JOS Unplugged podcast. Today, we take a close look at deep gluteal pain with our guest, Dr. Guillaume Gonzalez-Lomez. He joins us from NYU. We look at his article, Deep Gluteal Pain in Orthopedics, a Challenging Diagnosis. Dr. Gonzalez-Lomez, thank you so much for joining us today. Please, if you don't mind introducing yourself to our listeners and also kind of explaining a little bit what your practice makeup is and why this article was interesting to you to undergo.
Yeah, well, thanks, Stephanie. And Guillaume is fine. So very honored to be on the podcast and excited to talk with you about this topic. I'm a sports medicine trained orthopedic surgeon here on faculty at NYU, where I've been for, gosh, it's coming on 9 years. And, you know, I do see hip pathology and do hip arthroscopy. And often we see this crossover into patients who have this deep gluteal pain. And as you can imagine, it's ripe for the euphemism of choice. But it's a problem because these patients oftentimes have been referred around, are very frustrated, sometimes demoralized. It's a tough symptom to treat and identify, you know, diagnose. And I think that sometimes a lot of us are just kind of afraid of it. And so we sort of pass it on, you know, like a hot potato to the next guy. And so my interest in doing a bit of a deep dive into it was just, you know, to first educate myself on, you know, what the latest and greatest was out there. There's certainly things that we have done here at NYU that I think have been helpful, but wanted to see what was published, you know, what the evidence really said about the diagnostic panoply that's out there and how to treat it. And then also to sort of convey that to the rest of the membership. So hopefully take something that maybe seems a little enigmatic and make it something that's more tangible and easier to at least, you know, start the diagnostic process with.
Absolutely. Anytime we can take something that is wisping at straws and make it something more solid and tangible, I think we are all a big fan of. And that's one thing that really brought my attention to your article is it's a hard problem and it definitely comes in. And we see it in multiple genres, not just sports medicine, but trauma, general orthopedics, pediatric orthopedics, as well as total joint replacement, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is definitely something that reaches a lot of listeners and a lot of providers. And so I agree. Let's take a deep dive and look in and go through it. So your article does a great job. I love the outline where we really dive into the anatomy and then go through your history, physical, treatment strategies, et cetera. One thing I saw that was really interesting in the anatomy part was that even if the sciatic nerve has about 12% of strain on the sciatic nerve that's maintained past 1 hour, that can cause permanent damage. And that was something that I thought was really interesting that I did not know. Have you seen that happen in practice? Has it just more so in the literature?
Yeah, so that's more based on animal models. And as we know, the conversion and applicability to humans is sometimes not the best. But I think it's still an important point, which is that we think of the sciatic nerve as a pretty robust nerve, and it is. But if it is under a lot of strain, it will become dysfunctional. And, you know, in some cases, if it's kind of a permanent problem, then it can be irretrievably damaged. And so it's important to understand that. I have not seen, at least, you know, barring really severe trauma, and obviously I think, you know, the spine surgeons out there have certainly seen, you know, sciatica that's gone on to be irreversible. But in general, you know, for what we're talking about, that kind of deep gluteal pain pathology, I've not seen, you know, permanent motor sensory dysfunction of the sciatic nerve.
That's encouraging because that stat was definitely a little nerve-wracking as you're kind of reading through. And so I think the first part where I really kind of wanted to hone in was the history. And you kind of talk about your differential diagnosis with this deep gluteal pain. For all the listeners out there, Dr. Gonzalez-Lomez has a phenomenal table one. And if that's the only thing that you look at in the paper, I think that will definitely make a big difference. But that's one thing that I'd love to have you kind of walk through us for all of our listeners who don't have the visual. Is kind of talking through deep gluteal syndrome, hamstring syndrome, ischiofemoral impingement, pudendal nerve entrapment, posterior trochanteric bursitis. That's definitely one that we commonly see, femoral acetabular impingement, sacroiliac disorders, and lumbosacral radiculopathy. Those are all on that differential and kind of going through what's different about their onset. When do they have pain sitting? Which ones have pain walking? And kind of which ones have radiation and things like that?
Absolutely. And, you know, just in listening to you kind of enumerate the the entire differential, it's a lot. So I don't want this to become a cure for insomnia for our listeners. But, you know, I would say maybe we could break it down. The first three that you mentioned, deep gluteal syndrome, hamstring syndrome, ischiofemoral impingement, those I sort of consider the kind of mainstay of what we talk about when we're discussing deep gluteal pain. I think some of the other conditions are in that differential for sure. And we can discuss them a little bit later. But I think those three are the ones where when we've ruled everything else out, and the other things are things that, you know, a lot of us have a pretty good handle on, right? Like intra-articular pathology, whether it's FAI or hip arthritis, you know, generally we're going to do a pretty good job diagnosing that. Same thing with, you know, lumbosacral radiculopathy, even sacroiliitis, you know, those are a little bit more straightforward. But the first three, deep gluteal syndrome, hamstring syndrome, and ischiofemoral impingement, those are a little less common. And so I think it's good to sort of break those down a little bit. So, you know, with deep gluteal syndrome, that's what I sort of see as the modern version of piriformis syndrome, which, you know, has been around for a while as a diagnosis, perhaps a little bit controversial. But the idea is that either the piriformis or some other of the short external rotators or these fibrovascular bands that can form around that area, they apply some compression and irritation to the sciatic nerve. And so that's where the pain is going to emanate. And we are going to look for a history and physical that corroborate that pathology. So oftentimes this is going to have insidious onset. You know, you can have trauma, for example, in the setting of a hematoma, but in general, it's going to be something that, you know, builds up insidiously over time. Most of these patients will have some pain when they're sitting for a little while. And that's just because, again, that sciatic nerve is getting stretched in the back. And so those bands are applying compression to it. And, you know, I think one thing that's important to note is in many of these conditions, even though they do affect the sciatic nerve, you don't necessarily get the radiating symptoms that you would expect. And I think it has to do with around the sciatic nerve, there's rich innervation. And so I think some of that deep gluteal pain emerges from irritation there focally, and not necessarily that the nerve itself is compressed as it might be, you know, classically in radiculopathy. So again, for these patients, onset probably typically insidious. They're going to have pain after about 20, 30 minutes sitting, not right away, but it is relieved with walking. And I think that's helpful to differentiate it from ischiofemoral impingement, where you're going to get a little bit more pain with extension of the hip. And what's happening there is you're basically compressing the area between the ischium and the femur. So whether it's the greater trochanter or the lesser trochanter, but you're going to be compressing that area. So in hip extension, you're going to get some symptoms. And then with deep gluteal pain syndrome, you can get radiation, but not always. And I think that's important to remember that not all of these syndromes are going to radiate down the leg. So that sort of summarizes that. Hamstring syndrome, I think that's one that's a little bit more tangible for everyone just because we know where they attach. You can palpate the ischial tuberosity. But in terms of what patients report, this is one where they're either going to have an event. So oftentimes we'll see runners that, you know, were having their typical run and then either felt something tweak up near the ischium, not quite a pop, not a hamstring avulsion, but they felt something tweak. Or the next day they wake up and they're like, man, I don't know what I did yesterday, but my ischium is really painful. So other times it actually emerges more insidiously. And then again, these are patients that are going to have pain when they're sitting for a long time. Makes sense. They're on their ischial tuberosity. And one very telltale sign is if patients tell you that they have pain on heel strike, because that's when the hamstring is being engaged somewhat eccentrically. And so that's when it's going to bother them the most. Again, they can sometimes get some radiating pain if the sciatic nerve is irritated, but not necessarily. And then finally, ischiofemoral impingement. What's interesting with this condition is that inflection, so in other words, when patients are sitting, they typically won't feel pain. And so that's a good differentiator from the other two syndromes. they'll instead get more pain when they're in extension. So when they're walking, especially with that back leg. And then again, these patients can get some radiating symptoms if the sciatic nerve is irritated enough, but they can also just get that local deep gluteal pain.
That is super helpful. And I agree. I think those three are the ones that I definitely wanted to learn more about. I think our listeners also are grateful to kind of hear and dive deep into that, because you're right. We get a lot of exposure to hip arthritis, FAI, greater trochu bursitis, lumbosacral radiculopathy, et cetera. So really kind of diving into those more vague syndromes that can easily be overlooked that cause these patients to circle back and around from provider to provider. So that's a great segue kind of going into our physical exam. And you did a great job kind of alluding to some of these tests that you brought up in your paper with excellent pictures. Once again, I encourage all the listeners to take a peek at the physical exam pictures because I thought they were extremely helpful. But in figure two, you talk about the long stride test. And that one test helps differentiate two different syndromes, one on the front leg and one on the back. And so maybe if you could kind of describe the long stride test and then maybe talk about your piriformis test, your set of threes, and which ones you find the most helpful in clinic.
Yeah, absolutely. So the long stride test, it's kind of dovetailing on what we just talked about. You know, that back leg is in extension, it's really compressing all those structures between the ischium and the femur. So you just have a patient take long strides, you know, find a nice hallway for them. And if when that back leg is in extension, they are feeling some pain, you want to be suspicious for ischiofemoral impingement. And then on the flip side, like we were just talking about, if they have pain with that heel strike of the front leg, that is generally going to indicate it's more of a hamstring issue. So that's kind of nice, two for one, very efficient test that you can do to look at that. As far as the piriformis tests, you know, there's several out there. The ones that I like the most are the piriformis resistance test or stress test, where you basically, and you can do this in a few different ways. The way that I've always done it is you have a patient lie on their side, you know, lateral decubitus, and then you have the affected leg essentially externally rotate against resistance. And I think one thing that's important is to actually have your hand in the area of pain and ask the patients if the pain is reproduced in that area. Because I think sometimes if you say, well, does that hurt? They may not necessarily have the wherewithal to tell you, yeah, it hurts. And it hurts exactly where you want it to hurt for this test to be positive, right? So I think that that's important to do. Another one that I like is the piriformis stretch test. Really simple. You have patients sit off the end of the table and then flex their hip up. You're essentially basically doing like a straight leg raise, but seated. And you then internally rotate and slightly adduct the leg with the knee straight. And what that does is it puts that piriformis essentially on stretch. And so if the sciatic nerve is already a little bit irritated under the tendon or under the fibrovascular bands around there, you know, that'll be positive. So yeah, those are the two that I like. There's a few others that are out there, but I think in general, they're kind of permutations of those.
And with the piriformis stretch test, is that a radiating pain that goes past the knee that tells you it's positive, or is that just at the pinpoint area of the piriformis causing pain, or either?
Great question. And it can be both. And again, for that one, I do like to also, unless the patient is you know, 7 feet, I'd like to actually place my hand in the area of pain just to reinforce to them where I want that pain to be positive, for that to be a positive test. But they can get some radiation. Now, obviously, if they do, you want to make sure you're ruling out other causes of sciatica.
That's super helpful. And of course, we know, and you did a great job explaining, we always don't want to forget our basics of just watching the patient walk with gait or gait analysis, doing passive and active range of motion, checking Fader and Faber, and all of the like, manual palpation, like you reiterated multiple times. So that is extremely helpful. Could you touch briefly on some of the non-orthopedic differentials that should be crossing our mind that we don't want to rule out or forget about, especially if our musculoskeletal exam is not really hitting on target?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, just to kind of go back for a second, you mentioned like the basic test. And I think it's really important to remember that 15 to 30% of, for example, of FAI presentations are atypical. So they don't have the classic groin pain. They'll have posterior or lateral pain. So sometimes and I do this all the time, you know, we just get in efficiency mode. It's like, well, that's not the hip, but you know, it's important to do those tests, and you'd be surprised at how many times you actually get a positive test when you thought that that wouldn't be the problem just based on the patient's history. Later on, we can talk about other diagnostic tests, but certainly focal injections are very helpful as well. But yeah, you know, I think it's a great question to think about the non-ortho stuff because it's there. And again, I think this is sometimes why pain in this particular area is a little scary because that, you know, it starts to get into the perineum and just, you know, places that we are really not that familiar with. But certainly GYN causes can lead to posterior pain. You can have unusual cysts, tumors, endometriosis can sometimes cause pain in that area. Then you can also have intrapelvic nerve entrapment. So that's something that we're just not trained to deal with. But just going off of what you said, I think that's really important. You know, if the physical exam does not yield anything, then you got to start thinking that something else might be going on. And so that's the time to widen the net and make sure you get the reinforcements, our colleagues in different specialties to come in and help. So certainly you can get ABMs, you know, arteriovascular malformations, things that, you know, just basically mass occupying lesions that can cause a lot of these symptoms. And that's an easy one, right? Once you get the imaging and you see it there, you're like, okay, well, you know, at least we got it. But definitely listen to that physical exam. Because if it doesn't fit, then you've got to look elsewhere.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good point too, that a lot of times when this doesn't fit, especially when it's involving kind of the pelvic region, is to not forget about abuse situations too. It's so easy for orthopedic surgeons, myself included, to be like, not my area. I don't want to go there. But so many times we as orthopedic surgeons will see athletes and see patients that are at risk for this. And we can be the kind of the flag catcher and then pipeline them into the people who need to do what their expertise is to get them counseling or get them more help or some of that. And so to not be afraid to peer in and ask that question of like, has anything happened? And do you feel safe? And, you know, the basics. So I think when we get into this region, it's definitely important not to forget.
I think that's an extraordinary point. And you're absolutely right. You know, for a lot of people, this might be a cry for help, right? The only way they know to reach out. And you just have to have your antenna out for that, right? Because patients won't necessarily come and be completely forthright with that. You know, a lot of times this is their way of just saying, you know, something's going on. I think similarly, and we touched on it just right at the beginning of the conversation, but, you know, these are patients that oftentimes are extremely frustrated. I mean, these are patients that are tearful. I mean, they've just been, you know, hopefully it hasn't been abuse. Obviously, that's a different situation. But even when it hasn't, they've just been to a lot of doctors. They are demoralized. And I think just acknowledging that at the beginning, not that every patient presents the same way, but if you get a patient who's just been dealing with this for months or even years, I think it's just an important acknowledgement to get out there right off the bat and say, look, I get you've been going through a lot. You know, we're going to do our best. I think it just puts both of you on the same team because I think they're very used to being ignored and passed along. So I think that establishment of a therapeutic alliance can go a long way.
I think that's such a huge point, and especially developing a respect and trust in the gluteal pelvic region is super important. And so to be able to have that, because then they can trust and communicate. They don't fight as much on exam, et cetera, et cetera. And to finally know, hey, this doc is going to listen to me. And I don't know if we're going to get an answer, but at least it's going to go further than where I've been before. I think that makes a really big difference. So I want to touch on two things before we get into some of the treatment. One is focal injections and one is imaging. So to decide which we talk about first, will you do injections without imaging? If so, let's talk about that. If you do not, let's talk about what imaging you get first.
Yeah, we're at least working with x-rays, right? We want to have something to go by. And again, that's going to rule out a lot of potential pathologies like arthritis, let's say. But yeah, so typically we'll start off with injections. I personally will oftentimes get imaging first just because, you know, it is fairly easy, at least in this country, to get more advanced imaging looking at the soft tissue. So MRIs are good. If you have good ultrasound acumen or a good ultrasonographer at your institution, that's another very good way to look at that area. And so I would recommend starting off with that. I think with injections, you know, a very good one to start off with is to make sure you fully ruled out intra-articular hip pathology, just because that is such a common issue, right? That's such a common pathological entity. So you don't want to necessarily be chasing zebras down when that's staring you right in the face. So with or without the corticosteroids, I mean, just a local anesthetic injection, if you're comfortable doing it under ultrasound yourself or send it to the IR suite, I think that's just a really good way to rule that out as a possible entity. And then similarly with the other conditions, whether it's around the hamstring, whether it's in the ischiofemoral space, that's one where I'll often refer to IR, to interventional radiology, just because they're used to dealing with that all the time. And I don't know how it is for you, but the ultrasounds we get in the clinic are atrocious. And it seems like the ones they get in IR look like, is there like MRI cuts? So I let them, you know, use their higher end toys to figure that out. But I think those two are very helpful to differentiate if the pain is in the ischiofemoral interval or more over the ischial bursa where the hamstring is. And then similarly in the piriformis area, you know, one thing that can be helpful as a diagnostic test is actually Botox. So a few people have looked at this. I don't know that I would say this is a definitive treatment, but if you do inject the piriformis muscle with some Botox and the pain goes away, then that's obviously very suggestive of it being a deep gluteal syndrome, aka piriformis syndrome. So I think that it can be a very helpful tool. And look, these are not common, so they don't always show up. But when they do, I mean, it's a relief to know that that's the problem. And then you can decide how you're going to go about treating it.
Very helpful. And then with treating, I mean, obviously, in the abstract, you kind of elaborated that non-surgical treatment is the mainstay. There are times when we go on to surgical treatment. So what is the non-surgical treatment for these conditions? Are they different from one another for especially those top three differentials that we're kind of talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Great question. So we try always for non-op treatment, just because the operative treatment can sometimes be fairly invasive and it tends to have extended recovery. So if we can, we try to use, obviously, injections sometimes take care. I like to think of injections sometimes as sort of resetting the thermostat. So if suddenly that area has just been bathed in inflammation and it's used to being a little bit more inflamed, sometimes a cortisone injection can even be curative when coupled with physical therapy. I think establishing, you mentioned the trust that goes into treating this area. Not every physical therapist, you know, just like us, just like orthopedists, right? Not every physical therapist is comfortable treating in this area. So it's really helpful to have someone who is. There are more physical therapists now that are comfortable treating the pelvis and, in fact, performing pelvic manual therapy. Many times they're highly specialized in that. So it is helpful to have, you know, one of those on your Rolodex, just because a standard PT clinic may not have seen this very much. And certainly some of these conditions can benefit from something like that. But I think physical therapy is really important. And again, good PT. I always ask patients what they've been doing in PT. If they answer, well, I rode a bike for 20 minutes and then I got stim, I start to get a little concerned that, you know, maybe they're not getting effective treatment. So just make sure that, you know, it's easy to write a prescription for PT, but make sure they're actually getting the right treatment. And then, like we just discussed, I think Botox can be helpful for the piriformis and can actually differentiate it from the other two that we discussed, ischiofemoral impingement and hamstring syndrome. And there's a few other things out there. You know, PRP has not yielded great results for proximal hamstring tendonitis. I think that may be kind of a patient-by-patient issue. I don't think it's crazy to try. But I think it's important to also bake in the correct expectations. And extracorporeal shockwave therapy has also been tried with some mixed results. But, you know, those are also non-invasive or relatively non-invasive. And, you know, I think always worth trying before you start recommending surgery.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Those are really good tips. I will definitely remember. And then for the interest of time, moving on to surgical interventions. So what are some of the surgical interventions? And then do you have any pearls as you're going through it of selection and who you might not ever try and go down that road with? So any like distinct contraindications for surgery?
Yeah, just to sort of focus on that, the big three that we discussed, you know, if you're thinking piriformis syndrome, you've diagnosed it, you had a positive Botox trial, but the patient's having pain again, doing a release, I mean, that certainly has helped in those patients who have a good, strong diagnosis. And more recently, we've started to do piriformis releases endoscopically. One thing that I will say is, you know, with the endoscopic approach, it is absolutely critical to keep an eye on time. This isn't a joint that's contained by a capsule. This is an open area where fluid infiltrates. And there have been cases of compartment syndrome reported in the gluteus maximus or in the muscles around the thigh. And that can actually be devastating because unlike compartment syndrome in the calf, oftentimes, you know, the patients will have a transient period of pain and then it'll sort of resolve. But you can remember we talked about how sensitive the sciatic nerve is to stretch, right? Well, if you're adding high levels of pressure, iatrogenically created pressure with a pump, you could potentially cause some damage to the sciatic nerve. And even if patients don't have a full loss of function, they will have persistent pain in that area and maybe some partial loss of function. So I think this is something that should be practiced first. You shouldn't try your first endoscopic sciatic release or piriformis release on a patient, a live patient. I think it's an area that even for hip arthroscopists, we're just not that familiar with when we start. So just make sure you have, you know, a couple of reps under your belt before you, you know, start trying this out. So I think that is just an important pearl. And then the other point is that it's not just the piriformis tendon. Those fibrovascular bands around it are oftentimes the symptomatic problem. So the beauty of the endoscopic approach is you really see them and you can kind of go through all the way to the greater sciatic notch, just follow that sciatic nerve. And once you get somewhat facile at it, it's pretty quick and you can take care of those bands and the recovery afterwards is obviously a lot quicker with those smaller incisions. So that's for the piriformis syndrome. For hamstring syndrome, you know, there's a few different approaches. The kind of European approach, you know, most popularized in Finland has been to actually release the hamstring. So the idea there, this is maybe kind of a corollary to something like tennis elbow, where the tendons are just working a little extra hard. And if we just release the area that's under tension, the symptoms get better. And they've reported some pretty good results with that. The other option is, of course, to actually cut into the tendon if there's a partial tear, identify that tear, and then occasionally use anchors to reattach whatever's torn back to the ischial tuberosity. And then finally, for ischial femoral impingement, that's a tough one because basically you have bony impingement that's covered by tendon and soft tissue on both sides. So in one way or another, you're going to have to take that soft tissue off in order to take the bone off. So you can either do it at the lesser trochanter or at the ischium. And with the lesser trochanter, it's probably a little bit more straightforward because you can sort of burr that down while still leaving the iliopsoas attached. With the ischium, that's been tried as well, but that's, you know, you have to steel yourself for that. That takes a lot of guts because you're basically detaching the hamstring, taking down the protuberant ischial tuberosity and then reattaching the hamstring. So it's a big deal, but the results seem to support it in the right setting.
Yeah, I saw some of the results even showed the modified Harris hip scores going from 51, which is poor hip outcome, to 94 out of 100, which is excellent hip results. And so at the 2 years after the partial endoscopic resection of the lesser troch in patients with ischiofemoral impingement, I thought that was really interesting. Because it is promising. Obviously, we want all of our surgeries to do extremely well. It's what our patients want too. And we know that, especially in harder diagnoses, that can't always happen. But overall, at least the results that you were able to share with us, looks like about 80% or more improvement in most of these different surgical interventions. So I think that goes to show that patient selection is super important to make that surgery go very well. And just one last question with the ischial femoral impingement, when taking the lesser troch versus the hamstring, which do you choose and how does it affect your postoperative rehabilitation?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I have never taken down the hamstring and then the ischial tuberosity. Maybe I'm just too cautious. I mean, I think that that is a really big imposition on the healing powers of the body. But I think it's reasonable in the right setting. I think if someone has a very prominent ischial tuberosity, that might be the way to go, right? You always want to treat the pathology. I have taken down the lesser troch and generally had not had to do anything to the iliopsoas. So just leave it there. And so once you're there, you basically protect them for, I'll have them be on crutches for just a couple of weeks. And what you want to do is just have, you know, kind of make sense, just have them not use their hip flexors as much in that early postoperative period. So usually the first 6 weeks, just try to avoid any kind of resistance with hip flexion. But other than that, I do let them walk after 2 weeks. Generally, they'll protect themselves. And the results have actually been pretty good. I will say if I'm really critical with the results, there's probably always just a touch of residual weakness in hip flexion, but pretty minimal. And I guess the one final thing I'll say is when you look at a lot of these studies that look at the actual surgical management, so not just the diagnosis, but the surgical management, you find that it comes down to just a handful of papers that are reporting on this. So I still think that treatment for deep gluteal pain syndrome is in its nascency. And I think that it's just important to realize that, that a lot of the people that are publishing are still pioneers. And I think it's always good to sort of have a conservative bent when you're approaching this diagnosis, because we don't necessarily have decades and decades of experience like we do in other conditions.
Well, I definitely appreciate your time and all of your pioneering experience, as you are certainly a pioneer in this field as well. Your expertise has been wonderful to hear. I've been really, really enjoyed getting to pick your brain about all of this. I could talk to you for a whole lot more time, but we definitely want to be respectful of our listeners' time. And we look forward to having you back on the podcast at some point if we can.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on, Dr. Pierce. I really appreciate it. Look forward to the next time.
And that concludes our December episode of JS Unplugged. We hope you'll join us next month in 2022 as we learn about anterior impaction pilon fractures having poor outcomes, understanding penicillin allergy, cross-reactivity, and antibiotic selection in the preoperative setting. And we invite American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery President Dr. Daniel Guy to delve into what really matters. Perfect timing as we all begin reprioritizing as the beginning of the year starts and January takes us into the next chapter of our lives. We hope you have a safe and wonderful holiday season, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next year.